The headlines this hour: Israeli forces attack Palestinian protesters in a village in the Negev desert, injuring one protester critically. Russia says the recent security talks with NATO were unsuccessful, and that Moscow could deploy military hardware to Cuba or Venezuela. And Iran and Syria set the ground for a new era of economic cooperation between Tehran and Damascus. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Hundreds of Palestinians are protesting the demolition of their homes by the Israeli regime in a Bedouin village in the Negev desert. Protesters are objecting to an Israeli plan to relocate thousands of Palestinians in the region to other places. Israeli forces have reportedly attacked peaceful protesters and have used tear gas and water cannons to disperse them. Reports regime forces opened fire on the protesters, shooting one Palestinian in the head. Several others also were arrested. The Negev Desert is historically inhabited by Arab tribes, socially related to the tribes of the Sinai, the Arabian Peninsula, and Jordan. The Palestinian Authority says Israel is committing crimes against Palestinians in the Negev region. And we have reached our correspondent Mona Kandil of the West Bank to get some perspective on Palestinian protests in the Negev Desert.
What's happened in the last 2 days is that Israeli Jews were trying to plant trees in these areas, destroying and demolishing Bedouin properties there. An issue considered by the Bedouins who live there, the Palestinian Bedouins, of course, in the villages of Al-Atrash and Sawa there, they consider them, it's an attempt to force them out of the of their communities, move them to other areas. So they decided to protest today. There was a protest. Immediately, Israeli police officers and Israeli soldiers raided those two Palestinian villages, attacked the protesters. A number of people were arrested and others were wounded. The Israeli police fired heavy tear gas and rubber-coated bullets. At least one Palestinian was shot in the head, and he's in serious condition. However, Palestinians there insist that they will not allow such a new Israeli plan to pass, and they will not allow the Israeli Jews to plant there in their areas, because they inherited these lands from their grandfathers just before even 1948.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Tensions heating up between Russia and the West. Moscow says sanctions against President Vladimir Putin would mean a complete breakdown of ties. The Kremlin spokesman has described as unsuccessful Wednesday's talks with NATO in Brussels. Separately, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the talks led to no progress, and thus there is no need for further discussion in the coming days. The senior diplomat says the U.S. and its allies rejected Russia's key demands, including guarantees that NATO will not further expand eastwards. He has accused the Western side of lacking flexibility, refusing to rule out the possibility of Russian troop deployments to Venezuela and Cuba. In recent months, Moscow's ties with the West have taken a turn for the worse, with both sides warning about a new armed conflict in Europe. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator joining us from Moscow. We also have Mike Billington, Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia. I'd like to welcome to you both. Fred Weir, looking at the progress of these talks, or lack of it, I should say, was pretty evident before they even started, and at this point it seems like they're going to discontinue. What are we looking at now if that were to happen, which it appears that it will? Are we looking at U.S. sanctions, the next step for the U.S. against Russia?
I don't think we should be too swift to declare these talks over and dead. They will continue. They may go to a lower level, to committees and so on. But I think there's an emerging consensus. If you read commentary, I mean really high-level expert commentary from both sides, there are the outlines of compromises, even though the big maximal positions on both sides look irreconcilable. I think they both knew that going in, and they have vented their maximal positions now in those big high-level, high-profile talks. Now I think there will be some, discussion about the details, things that don't require either side to give up on principles, but might just move the ball a little bit. And what we need is a new security architecture in Europe. I think everybody agrees with that, and that the Russia of today is not the Russia of the 1990s, when the present architecture was more or less unilaterally formed. So therefore, belatedly and begrudgingly, I think that the West is coming around to the idea that they're going to have to provide Russia with some satisfaction to its demands. I think we shouldn't give up on our optimism yet.
Okay, so Mike Billensing, new security guarantees or arrangements, as Fred Weir indicated, is something that Russia is asking for. During the talks, it seems like NATO did not even look at the proposal that was set forward. At the other end of the spectrum, we're looking at compromises, which, again, these talks don't seem to have reached any yet. Are we looking at any to possibly happen, and what can they be in your eyes?
Let me mention that I can barely hear you, but I did hear you. I totally agree with your other guest. I think the declaration that the talks are finished are wrong. It's part of a Western media basically lying about the situation, blaming everything on Russia and so on. But people do recognize, especially in Europe, that the reason the Russians did not strongly challenge the security issue, going back to the earlier spreading of NATO against the wishes of the Russians, is that the Russians were in an economic mess in the 90s and in the first part of the 21st century, and were not as strong militarily. Since 2007, the world knows from Vladimir Putin's speech in Munich in 2007 that the Russians were on the verge of catching up and have now at this point caught up and perhaps gone beyond the U.S. Western military capacity. They have the strength to challenge this attempt to move NATO forces up to their border. The Russians, of course, do remember when Napoleon and later Hitler brought forces up to their border and what the consequences were, and they will not allow it, and they absolutely should not. I would emphasize what your other guest said, whose name I didn't catch, unfortunately, is that what's needed is a new architecture. The LaRouche Organization, the Schiller Institute, fully agree with that. On the other hand, the danger is not gone by a long shot. We have madmen, and I mean madmen, in the U.S. military industrial complex who need a war, and even though they know they could not win such a war against either Russia or China, you then create the conditions in which the madmen like Admiral Richard, the head of the U.S. Strategic Command, who believes a nuclear war is likely, and others, including Senator Weicker in the U.S. Senate, who has literally called for a first-strike nuclear bombardment of Russia. I agree this is far from likely, but this is the mentality of certain madmen, and therefore, especially since the presidents in the United States do not rule by dictate, as Trump showed when he demanded the U.S. pull out of the Syrian war and other wars, and the military simply ignored him. The same is certainly true now when you have people like Blinken and the Wall Street military-industrial complex basically making the decisions. So this is a crucial moment in which the direct relationships between Putin and Biden are critical.
Sure.
Biden is a troubled president, to put it politely. But nonetheless, he appears to be aware that the danger of nuclear war is great, that he and Putin and the other P5 members did sign the statement saying that nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. So we have to act on the basis of that potential while maintaining a warning to the world that the West could indeed be sleepwalking into a thermonuclear war.
Well, the fact, Fred Weir, that Moscow says that it could deploy military hardware to Cuba or Venezuela, do you think that that could mean that there are other variables that could be used that's not related to just NATO, U.S., and Russia, that perhaps concessions can be made, given, so to speak, on other issues, perhaps, that the U.S. and NATO don't agree with Russia, in particular the U.S., that can then come up to what you said was a compromise of some sorts?
Right, right. Well, they're pulling your leg on that subject, but they're also making a very strong polemical point, which is the United States would freak out at the thought of Cuba or Venezuela joining a Russian or Chinese-led military alliance.
You're saying that's just posturing?
Well, yeah, I think so. But it's not pointless. It is an important argument. The United States is coming in to these talks saying this sort of thing is not done in the 21st century. We have these sovereign states, and their will is paramount. And why? They can join any military alliance they want. So the Russians are simply making a rather obvious counter-narrative point. So what if we put troops in Cuba? What would you think?
Uh-huh.
Like, put the shoe on the other foot. That's the level that that's on, and it's a perfectly valid argument. I don't think Russian troops will be embarking to either of those countries anytime soon. But yes, this is a big, broad, far-ranging debate that's going on now. I'm really impressed, since I've been covering this for years and years, and in the last 7-8 years I've felt sunk in this new Cold War, this galloping new tensions and the kinds of lack of communication and misunderstanding that didn't even exist during the real Cold War that I grew up in. It's really bad. And finally, people on both sides, but especially in the West, where they got this hysteria pretty bad, they're starting to wake up and look at it with fresh eyes and see that there is a lot to the Russian position. There's a lot of logic to it. It's not ideological. It's about Russia's national interests, its security, basic things like not having its neighbors members of a hostile military alliance, which the United States never would tolerate. These kind of things need to be discussed, and it'll take a long time to grope toward compromises that will create satisfaction. It's very early days in this process, but there are a lot of reasons to hope that it will progress and reach some kind of better situation in 2022.
Okay, we'll see. I wish we had more time. Thank you very much, Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator from Moscow, Mike Billington. Many thanks for your contribution.
One more thing. Executive. Let me just mention that behind all of this is the severe breakdown crisis in the Western financial system and the danger of a severe hyperinflation. You have to recognize that the West is facing a multiple series of crises over Russia and China, over the economy, over the pandemic. And this throws some sense that there will be sane actions into a bit of a skewed position. So we have to be very cautious about the need to take measures to deal with the collapse of the Western financial system if we're going to deal with the strategic crisis.
Are you talking about the fact that China might get involved with Russia regarding this? Is that what you mean? Because obviously that is how it could put a dent on the U.S. economy as a whole.
If the U.S. were to do what they're threatening and throw Russia off of SWIFT and so forth, it would destroy the U.S. and the European economies. And because it's already in a near breakdown crisis because of the printing of literally trillions of dollars over these past years, not for the real economy, but to bail out financial institutions and derivative bubbles,
right.
This we're therefore sitting on the brink of a general breakdown crisis of what is known as the world financial system, although, as we know, Russia and China are able to run their economies and their relations with most of the rest of the world independent of the dollar if they are forced to do so.
Sure.
So we must resolve this breakdown crisis in the West. We can't put that aside if we're going to succeed in solving the strategic crisis.
Thank you very much for that. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, Virginia. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Iran says the end of the conflict in Syria has ushered in a new era of economic cooperation between Tehran and Damascus. The Minister of Roads and Urban Development says the two countries have agreed to establish a free trade area. Rostam Qasemi says that Iran and Syria have also decided to set up a joint committee to review and to implement their previous agreements. According to the official, the two sides have also agreed to establish a joint bank to facilitate bilateral trade cooperation. Qasemi made the remarks after meeting the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. He is on a three-day visit to the Arab country for talks on bilateral ties. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a large-scale combined arms military exercise in the country's southeast. The drill, codenamed Muhammad Rasulullah, was held by the IRGC ground force in the southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. Various units took part in the drill, which involved missiles, artillery, drones, helicopters, and other military equipment. Iranian armed forces hold several routine military exercises throughout the year. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa, via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-67 Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight. A new study reveals how the gap has widened between the two sides of politics in the United States. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Urban C. Leonard Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Americans are even more divided than we thought. Stay tuned for more. The right thinks this, the left does that. The U.S. polarized politics are often described in binary terms, as if there were a monolithic right and a monolithic left, the only division between the two. Certainly, each side talks about the other this way. When we are with rural, heavily Republican friends, we often hear references to the left or liberals, with the occasional addition that they are all socialists. Unfortunately, categorizing and disparaging the other side this way not only makes dialogue across the aisle difficult, it obscures the significant points of disagreement within each of the camps. Depending on the issue, people of the left and right have more than a few things in common. If they appreciated that, they might more often find allies on the other side. The unmonolithic nature of both camps is the theme of a new study by the Pew Research Group titled Beyond Red and Blue. It's based on a July 2021 poll of 10,221 Americans, an unusually large sample size, plus interviews with some of those polled. Pew found 9 distinct ideological groups, 4 on the left, 4 on the right, and 1. The stressed sideliners, a mixture characterized mostly by minimal interest in politics. The study's subtitle summarizes its findings. Even in a polarized era, deep divisions in both partisan coalitions. Some of those divisions are striking. In 3 of the Republican coalition groups, more than 70% think most corporations make a fair and reasonable amount of profit. But in the 4th, the populist right, only 17% agree, a smaller percentage than in 3 of the 4 Democratic-leaning groups. Among faith and flag conservatives, 75% believe government policies should support religious values and beliefs. Under 30% of those in the other 3 Republican-leaning groups agree. Some 68% of committed conservatives and 61% of the ambivalent right hold that in foreign policy, the U.S. should take into account the interests of its allies, even if it means making compromises with them. Only 15% of faith and flag conservatives and 27% of the populist right agree. 2 of the Democratic coalition groups, the progressive left and the outsider left, say by margins of 71% and 63% that most U.S. laws and major institutions need to be completely rebuilt because they are fundamentally biased against some racial and ethnic groups. Only 29% of establishment liberals and 38% of Democratic mainstays agree. Fully 73% of the progressive left and 55% of the outsider left say the fact that there are some people in this country who have personal fortunes of $1 billion or more is a bad thing for the country. Only 39% of establishment liberals and 29% of Democratic mainstays think that, and ask if spending on police in your area should be decreased. 48% of the progressive left and 41% of the outsider left say yes, but only 22% of establishment liberals and 11% of Democratic mainstays. Jew's 169-page study report describes the nine groups in detail. Faith and flag conservatives are the oldest of the nine groups, overwhelmingly Christian and very active politically. The populist right among the groups least likely to be college-educated are among the highest share rural. These two groups account for 46% of the Republican coalition, 23% each. Committed conservatives are the most educated Republican group and very politically active. They are conservative on most issues, especially economics. The ambivalent right is conservative on issues like the size of government, but more moderate on immigration and some social issues. These latter two groups each represent 18% of the Republican coalition. The progressive left accounts for only 12% of the Democratic coalition, but is the most politically active group. The outsider left represents 18% and is the youngest of all nine groups, but among the least politically active. The Democratic mainstays at 28% are relatively less educated, but the most racially and ethnically diverse group. Establishment liberals, 23%, are highly educated, highly politically engaged, and fairly diverse racially and ethnically. On many issues, to be sure, the differences between the two coalitions are much bigger than the differences within each coalition. Take racial injustice. Among the Democratic groups, upward of 70% say much more needs to be done to ensure equal rights. In none of the Republican groups did even 25% concur. As you'd expect, Democratic groups overwhelmingly favor a larger government, while Republican groups overwhelmingly favor a smaller one. And there is an urban-rural divide of sorts. Among the Democratic groups, about 10% to 20% live in rural areas, while among the Republican groups, it's 30% to 40%. But even on fundamental questions like the size of government, there are internal divisions. While Democrats generally want a bigger government, 63% of the progressive left favor greatly expanded government services, while only about a third of other Democratic groups go that far. Those internal differences can make a difference. For example, only two of the nine groups, faith and flag conservatives, and the populist right, want a bigger U.S. military. The rest don't. Therein lies the basis for a left-right coalition. Donk Review.
Hello and welcome to Donk Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich and whose book inspired the film, served as Labour Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Rice, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. Money. People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it. The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. New York now! New York now! Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. But the central idea of the fact that, you know, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so. But I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned. And sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard. And he said, you know, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realize the pool, the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
Yeah, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, that's kind of how it's working. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
There's strong arguments to be made in the film, and of course aided by great animation sequences,
yeah.
and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Tuition right now is clear. Something's wrong all over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but
great.
What we're beginning to see,
yep.
is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these,
yeah.
fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You
yeah.
used to use my book.
I used to use it.
Can
what
we just make, can you?
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again?
Mine.
Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him, actually, on this issue. And do you think Reich has sort of that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, so he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And,
but
and that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was the early elections when they were,
yeah.
filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly, and we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So, you know, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests. And the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue or Democrat to Republican or vice versa is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama, we've seen it with Trump, you know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so, Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out in, through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just, it's just kind of eating itself, and it's very much a, it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the, you know, the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So that's not surprising, but very
telling. It's not surprising, but it kind of helps, it helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how, or, you know, how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps, it helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of film does. It might get people to stand up and say, wait a minute, something has
it's
happened.
It's an empowering documentary.
Yeah.
And there's
a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing, and there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas, and then my phone bill. I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
That was a truly heartbreaking scene to watch there. And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories, the McDonald's worker and also the sort of farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living, and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Wright raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. and it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money, it's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that just exacerbates it. So this process, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, and the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of
understanding, at least it's a good starting point.
Yeah, I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
But it's just you know, watching the system get worse and worse. And he talked about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can see all that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated, and you saw him like in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And of course he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. But for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Because they're utilities. They're something everybody has to have. And
essential.
And that's kind of the, it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits
and so
put people, you know, make people poor.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was, one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. Yeah. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up.
That is very worrying indeed. And just as we end near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think, I'm sorry, Rich, do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in. And it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah. So I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on. And maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there. But I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.